Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tanya Toler, the host of the channel. Today, I'll be talking to Lisa Riley about her new book, The Invention of Norman Visual Culture, Art, Politics, and Dynastic Ambition, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. I, for one, love the title of this book, The Invention of Norman Visual Culture, and I'm excited to be talking to Lisa about ways Normans used art to legitimize their rule, and the interplay of art, politics, and dynastic ambition across medieval Europe. Lisa Riley, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Lisa, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself and perhaps what your current research is on.
Sure. I'm a faculty member. I'm actually the Commonwealth Professor of Architectural History at the University of Virginia. So I teach in the School of Architecture, and I also teach in the Art History program in a PhD program here. I'm the medieval architectural historian, and my current project's actually quite different from the Norman book. I've gone back to something I worked on while doing my master's at York University, and I'm looking at the 16th century stained glass program at the Church of St. Michael the Belfry, right next to York Minster.
Oh, fabulous. I'm already looking forward to it. Someone who's interested in glass and has been researching glass for my own PhD topic. So it's something that I'll definitely come back to you when that gets published. Okay, so in recent years, there has been a growing interest in the Norman visual culture, especially into the study of Norman Sicily. Among others, Isabel de la Jalleck's book on Arabic script on Christian kings, The Royal Garments from Norman Sicily, was published in 2017, and Winkler, Fitzgerald, and Small's edited volume, Designing Norman Sicily, Material Culture and Society, published in 2020, that comes to mind as well. So what is your explanation for such an interest in the Normans? And if I may, the sub-question, where does your own interest in the Normans come from?
Well, my own interest in the Normans did not start with Norman Sicily by any means. I was researching my PhD topics and ended up choosing Peterborough Cathedral in England as the subject of my dissertation and as the subject of my first book, because it's actually the best preserved Romanesque cathedral in England, and hence by the Normans, who rebuilt virtually all of England after the 1066 conquest. So that's how I got interested in Normans, without really knowing very much about Normans at all, I have to say initially. I just thought they were people from northwestern France. And while I was finishing that up, I had the opportunity to visit Sicily, which I wanted to do because I kept, you know, people did not really talk about Sicily very much. This is in the late 80s. They didn't really talk about the Mediterranean. I mean, in the book, I talk about this, about how Sicily is this kind of outlier. A very famous architectural historian describes it as exotic and spicy. You know, it's something that doesn't fit in at all. And so I was able to do this trip to Sicily while I was actually house-sitting in Tuscany for a year writing my dissertation. And I was just really struck by these monuments that look so different from Peterborough or Ely or Durham or Saint-Étienne-et-Caen. And I thought, I know exactly what I want to do my next book on, because I knew I had to finish my dissertation and do my first book. I have to look at these and figure out how the same group of people produce things that look so completely different and what was going on with that. So that's really how it started. So it was a project with a pretty long genesis. I have to say I worked on this for quite a long time off and on, but that's where it began, because I just thought, how are these the same guys who built Peterborough Cathedral and they have these, you know, Mukarnas ceilings and all this stuff in Sicily?
Well, that's really interesting, because I started from the other end. So my first visit was actually to Sicily, and I did my master's degree. My dissertation was on the Mukarnas in Palermo. So, you know, I know only now, basically, when I am based in the UK, I am tracing all these steps of Norman architecture that you are writing about in your book. So it's quite interesting how we are basically complementing our own research here.
Interesting.
Yeah. But you say, I think what fascinated me in the first instance about this book was really bringing all these three territories together. So France and Normandy, the British Isles or England, and Sicily. So you're talking about the same group of people, you said. Who were these people? Who are these people called Normans?
Well, it's not identically the same people. It's the same group of people. The Normans, the name actually comes from Normanni, meaning the Northmen, because originally France, like many parts of Western Europe, is undergoing raids from Vikings from Scandinavia. You know, if you watch the History Channel or whatever channel it's on in Britain, there's certainly enough TV shows showing you these dramatic scenes of Vikings attacking, you know, Lindisfarne and places. So they're also coming into France and actually sailing up the Seine, which has its mouth in Normandy and goes through Normandy and all the way to Paris. And at a certain point, the French king realizes what a bad idea this is, basically, to have Normans sailing up to Paris, and cuts a deal with them where they can have this territory in northwestern France that had been part of the Carolingian Empire known as Neustria. And so they can have this northwestern territory, basically, if they'll contain themselves to that area and also convert to Christianity, because essentially they're the last group of people who have not converted to Christianity. And so the Treaty of Ept, and whatever year it is now, I can't remember, 9/11 or something, is signed, and they settle down in this area. There's quite a bit of debate about how much they kind of integrate with the local population, you know, about language and whether women are coming from Scandinavia or they're intermarrying. But there's clearly this arrival of this new group of people who convert at least nominally initially, but then within a generation or two go on to become really the major patrons of religious art and architecture in northwestern France.
Right. This is something that you begin your book with. You basically introduce Normans to the reader and the setting of the scene of who Normans were, how did they rise to power, and where this expansionist politics led them in subsequent centuries. But it's definitely something to easily admire, this story of success from Vikings to Normans. But was it really so straightforward? Was it really so easy, this integration, the settlements? And of course, we are talking about also using art to confirm that political ambition.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm an art historian rather than a historian, but there isn't a sense that the like indigenous inhabitants of Normandy are resisting them and rising up against them, which is what happened when they go to England, where the Anglo-Saxons are certainly resisting Norman conquest. There is debate about how much Scandinavian influence there is. Are Normans becoming completely Frenchified, or French people becoming more Scandinavianified? There is debate about that. They did have a phase during the raiding period where they were destroying a lot of these very early Merovingian monasteries along the banks of the Seine. Jimmy, as I talk about, is one of those that had experienced this kind of destruction. But then once they kind of established themselves, they seemed to realize that in order to look like a ruler, you had to be doing certain things. And one of those things is patronizing churches, as well as, you know, other, I mean, they had other buildings as well, but the churches survive. They're very active. And they also bring in some of the leading religious figures from like Lanfranc and people from other parts, St. Anselm, other parts of Europe, to kind of reestablish and, kind of solidify the kind of Christianity in the region. So they're very savvy, and they seem to really have a sense of what's appropriate for a ruler. I mean, there's no Viking king or anything like that. So this kind of, or Duke even, this kind of model hadn't existed. They're not familiar with this and bringing it with them from Scandinavia. But it seems like they kind of look around and begin to get this idea of how to be appropriate, and how they seem to want to make sure that they look like legitimate rulers. And so they want to look like other people who are ruling as well, who are Christian patrons of art.
Yes, exactly. This part of this success Normans enjoyed was also this exquisite sense for reformulation of local traditions and invoking those of rival political powers in order to reinvent and present themselves as legitimate political leaders. Could you speak, or could we speak even about Norman identity that could be seen or sensed through shared visual culture? Is there such a thing?
Well, I think that there is. I mean, one of my arguments in the book is it's not like they arrive and have this preformed Viking, you know, permanent monumental architecture that they're using, but there are clearly, you know, there are aspects of the Bayeux embroidery, for example, that people frequently feel come from Viking traditions. So the argument of the book is that they draw on a whole series of languages to formulate something that in the end seems to be distinctly theirs, in terms of how they bring in ideas, whether it's from Burgundy or the Holy Roman Empire or these other areas, and create this very distinctive architecture that's also just incredibly monumental. I mean, these buildings are huge. They're, you know, some of the biggest buildings for all of the Middle Ages, really. So they're putting a lot of resources financially into this endeavor. It's clearly very important to them. And these monasteries in Normandy, they're mainly founding or refounding monasteries, depending. And they're really monumental buildings that go on to be very influential in how medieval architecture continues to unfold. And one of the other things I talk about is people have tended to look at Norman architecture not for its own sake, but in terms of what Suger took from it when, you know, he built Saint-Denis, or, you know, what somebody from a later period took, as if it's just sitting there practicing to be Gothic rather than being something on its own self. But I think that they're very conscious of wanting to make an impression in how they draw on these ideas and models from other places, and yet their buildings don't look exactly like a Burgundian building or an imperial building.
Right. So discussing Normans in France, you write, and I quote here, "As an examination of Norman architecture reveals, the visual culture created under Norman patronage gave expression to the process which manifests continuity with local tradition together with new ideas. It is through this mixedness, this hybridity, that a new cultural identity was formed, one that conveyed legitimacy and continuity together with newness," end of quote. So I guess I'm tying in to what you've just explained to us, and with a question: how is this newness seen in Norman architecture in France? And if you can give us some concrete examples.
Well, if you look at Saint-Étienne-et-Caen, for example, which is one of the best known Norman buildings, its elevation with this harmonic facade. I mean, having the twin towers is something you do see earlier in like Holy Roman Empire architecture, but the way that it aligns specifically with the composition of the building behind it seems to be new. They do have originally timber ceilings at Saint-Étienne-et-Caen as well as elsewhere. Now they're stone vaults. So they can have those very large openings at ground level, middle level, and then the clear story above. So that kind of compilation of elements, some of them reflecting earlier traditions, but put together in a new way. And then the scale of the buildings is really on a kind of imperial scale. So you don't see that so much in other churches in France. So, you know, they are clearly aware of what's going on, and they've brought these people in. Particularly from Burgundy and other parts of France where there's already been an ongoing monumental architectural tradition, but they don't copy exactly from any one place. So, you know, there's a lot of debate about the exact sources, but those are some of the places that seem to be the most significant.
Right. It's very interesting the scale and how they managed to get it to that kind of huge buildings, especially when you think in what kind of huts the regular people would have lived at the same time, right?
Yeah.
And obviously building in stone as well, rather than building in the wood. So I guess that's also not random. It's very much selected material.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, it's out of Caen stone, Caen being this area in Lower Normandy. And I mean, so they had good local materials because transportation of building materials is usually the most expensive part of a medieval building. So they had the kind of natural resources to build what they want. But, you know, I often say to my students, when you go into these churches, you know, even if you're a phenomenally rich person or a king, there's no place a normal person is living that's like this space, right? I mean, the scale, they probably were painted with bright colors. They have stained glass. The amount of glass is phenomenally expensive. But even these early buildings have enormous windows relative. I mean, most people had no windows, but even if you were rich, you didn't really have lots of windows. And so it really is creating, I always say, this kind of heavenly space, because it's like nothing on earth that you otherwise would have experienced when you go into these. And it's not just Normans doing that, but they're certainly participating in this sense of creating this kind of otherworldly zone with these enormous buildings. You know, they don't have lavish sculptural decoration the way we see in, for example, Burgundy or Provence, but they were probably painted to look pretty colorful, and the scale as well. It's pretty over. I mean, even now when you drive across Normandy, you know, they stick out on the landscape.
Yeah, and they're very humbling experience when you walk inside in the main nave. It's you definitely feel this sort of, you know, extraterrestrial, if I may say that word, is it? Like it's something beyond my regular life, right? It's that transcendence on towards which they are alluding. And it's also probably, if I sensed correctly from your book, something that they'd done on purpose in order to establish their own political powers. And this is my statement for the richness, because obviously this money needed to come from somewhere. Where would the Normans in Normandy get their money from to erect such large buildings?
Well, the first wave of Normans are getting it just because they're given all the land in Normandy, right? I mean, it's a feudal system, and the king's saying, okay, now it's yours. So you're kind of rich from that. But a lot of the really big buildings come after the Norman conquest of England, because England likes Sicily, is one of the wealthiest parts of Western Europe. So basically, once William the Conqueror conquers or reclaims England, depending on your point of view about his right to rule there, he kind of resets the feudal system, and he takes all the land away from the Anglo-Saxons, or just about all the Anglo-Saxons, and redistributes it to these people who are already, you know, it's kind of like the 2%ers become the 1%er. I mean, they're already rich from the land in Normandy, and now they're given these vast estates in England as well. And so in some cases, the buildings are a little bit later, and the money's coming probably also from the fact that they now have these holdings in England too. But they all, you know, they also build phenomenal buildings all over England as well.
Right. So you mentioned England. So Norman conquest of England and this decisive battle at Hastings as 1066 sets this sort of scene for Norman presence on the British Isles. Mm-hmm. And you write that, and I quote here as well, concept of legitimate kingship in 12th century Europe was multifaceted. Several terms have already been used in connection with kingship: legitimacy, continuity, and divine providence, end of quote. So how did they legitimize their presence across the English Channel, and particularly in art? What kind of visual tools did they use for it?
Well, you know, in England, William's claim is not that he's conquering like you have it and I want it. He's claiming that he is the legitimate ruler, and that Edward the Confessor had promised it to him. And so he's going back, you know, and then that Harold basically double crosses him. And so he's going to claim what he says is rightfully his. So that's a really important part of the narrative. And that's the story, basically. I'm waving because I'm at my book. That's the story that the Bayeux embroiderer, Bayeux Tapestry, is telling, is the Norman version of events about how, you know, the events leading up to the promise and how he was supposed to get it, and Harold's a bad guy, and all the rest of it. So part of it is the Bayeux embroidery, which, you know, has probably as many unanswered questions as questions about it, but it certainly seems to have been made, ironically, by Anglo-Saxon artisans to represent this Norman view of these events. You know, at the same time, the Anglo-Saxons don't sit down and say, oh, this is great, we're so glad you're here. There are actually uprisings for quite a long time. In, you know, for at least 20 years, there are all these people rising up against them. The area around Peterborough, in fact, you know, one of the reasons Peterborough is so late in the story is because that was one of the major reasons regions rebelling against him all the time under Hereward the Wake. And the Peterborough monks, you know, are always backing the wrong guy because they're convinced that William's gonna go, which was kind of a mistake, as you might imagine. But you know, and William does go and completely flatten Yorkshire in the Herring of the North when that part of the country is rising up against him, and it's just devastated. And they say it's, you know, generations before the damage is repaired and food can be grown and things like that. So he does spend a fair amount of time kind of putting down these rebellions. But at the same time, in his ceremony to be crowned, he's very careful to use the ceremony that English kings had used, which I talk about. The proclamation is the same proclamation. He has it done in Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day, you know, the whole thing. So it looks very much like he's fitting in within this English tradition of coronation and ritual. And then there are ceremonies, loud ceremonies for him and his wife at Winchester and places like that, where he's again, you know, going to the same place. You go to Winchester at Easter for a crown wearing ceremony. You have this kind of ritual associated with it. And he's using all of the same language. So he doesn't, you know, with a king, it's not really like you want to be number one, right? You're supposed to be inheriting it. And part of the idea in the medieval mind was that if you won the battle, that probably means that God wanted you to win, that that's the divine providence part. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle also talks about, you know, basically we must have been really bad because, you know, this guy won. Like, what did we do? We really sinned. And this guy's now won. So there's this, in a way, almost acceptance of it as like, this is what God wanted to happen. Now, at the same time, you know, pretty quickly after the conquest, we begin to see buildings go up. Anglo-Saxon buildings, we don't have a lot of good remains of those. Even when they were large, large in footprint or ground plan, they seem not to have necessarily been monumental on the scale of some of the buildings in Normandy or on the continent. And so I know I have the statistic about some phenomenal number of buildings is replaced within 20 years. So these really enormous monastic buildings and cathedrals are built. Virtually every building is rebuilt. And then also there had been some castles because of Edward the Confessor, you know, actually grew up in Normandy. But really we see this enormous introduction of castles with these monumental stone structures coming with the conquest as well. So, you know, I always say, if you happen to have gone away on a long trip in 1066 and come back, you know, 20 years later, it would be like the invention of the skyscraper. It'd be unrecognizable the way the built environment was transformed quite rapidly. And, you know, they're really putting their mark on the territory. You see, you know, some of the people who he's given lands to at, you know, like Castle Headingham, there's this enormous castle put up. At other sites, they'll put up a castle and also patronize an abbey. The building I talk about the most in the book is Durham, which is a site of particular problems for him. I mean, Durham's the last big place before Scotland, and so you've always got to worry about the Scottish if you're and Durham, the people who's putting into power, the Bishop of Durham, you know, they kept getting murdered basically by these local Anglo-Saxons. So finally he puts in William of Saint-Calais, as he's called, to be abbot, who's really shrewd. I mean, the first thing he does is he ships the Anglo-Saxon abbots from Durham right out of town and brings in a new batch who may be Anglo-Saxon, but they're not with ties to the local community. And then William talks about the need to restore, and part of that is William talking about the need to restore the foundation of Durham back to being a Benedictine abbey, because it was founded by St. Cuthbert, one of the most important saints in England, a saint who rulers always came and appealed to his relics for endorsement. And so he takes these, they weren't Benedictines anymore, so he takes these Anglo-Saxon lay clerks and sends them away and brings in these Benedictine monks and talks about how we're going back to Cuthbert, we're going back to the real Durham. So again, it's this idea of continuity. He's very clever. And then he rebuilds this church for the shrine site of St. Cuthbert, and also a castle right next door to it. That's on the mound right immediately next to Durham. And Durham is really one of the biggest buildings ever. I mean, the walls are 10 feet thick. It's huge. The scale, because of the bases, start so high up off the floor. So it's just overwhelming when you walk into it and you really feel dwarfed. So it's really like nothing people would have seen before. And there, I think he is very clever about using motifs and ideas from conventional Anglo-Saxon buildings, like the decorations on the piers and the moldings, to create this very ornate container for the shrine that's on a kind of Norman scale and has an elevation similar to some buildings in Normandy, but then has all these other motifs that seem to come out of the Anglo-Saxon tradition. So it's quite a strong statement in an area where William was in particular having trouble.
Yeah, I remember when I first saw Durham Cathedral myself, and it's you cannot miss it from any angle that you are traveling there. It's so remarkable. The train, you know, the train line is basically also going nearly around the whole building. Obviously not right next to the building, but it's such a big mark on the town that you can see it from any angle. But what I found, correct me if I'm wrong, but I find it really interesting that Hall Cuthbert story, because wasn't it also that Durham became a pilgrimage site after the Lindisfarne was sort of attacked by the Vikings? So here you have attacking of the Vikings that needed, you know, all these poor monks, they fled Lindisfarne, settled in Durham, brought all this remains of the saint with them to establish the pilgrimage site, and now the whole city became the Norman statement of power. So it's quite interesting historically to see it.
The ultimate irony. That's yeah. Absolutely right. Because they wander around for years trying to figure out where to settle. And, you know, they're claiming that Cuthbert's like, we're done, I'm staying here, you know, and they kind of stop. But it's like a fabulous site because, you know, it's basically a peninsula with sheer cliffs surrounded by the River Weir on three sides. So if the Vikings managed to get that far to the interior of England, I guess they thought they'd be in a good position to defend themselves. So,
yeah, I mean, quite interesting from that angle. So you talk about Durham Cathedral. You talk about other important cities in England that got this new facelift, if you will, such as Winchester, Norwich, St. Albans, Bury, St. Edmunds. I mean, these are all extremely important locations that had, you know, a century of history prior Normans arrived there. And would you say these locations were targeted, if I may say, on purpose? So I guess where I'm going with this is also the symbolism of the location. So establishing your own rule in the locations that carry some sort of a symbol of the past with them, because something similar would have happened then also in Sicily.
Oh, no, I think that's absolutely what they're doing. You know, they want to show themselves to be continuing. I mean, even in Normandy, they're not really building on new sites so much until you get to Caen. The other ones like Jumièges are rebuilt, Fécamp. But in England, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, apart from Battle Abbey, which is on the battlefield, you know, they're building on, like, St. Albans is the first martyr, you know, Canterbury gets rebuilt. So it's always these sites that were really important that are now getting even grander kinds of containers for their shrines and for the monastic community as well. And he does bring in monks, particularly abbots from Normandy to kind of, you know, you want the church on your side, basically, because that's part of your legitimacy and you don't want these monks rising up against you. So, you know, Canterbury in particular right away, you know, begins to get these people like St. Anselm and Lanfranc who have been working with him in Normandy, and he brings them over to be the head of the church in England as well, so that there's a clear alliance between his political rule and these major religious institutions. You know, that's part of what you see in the Bayeux Tapestry is like Stigand's the bad guy, who's the Anglo-Saxon bishop crowning Harold, which, you know, he shouldn't be doing. So he gets the boot, certainly, ultimately. I think there's only maybe one or two abbots. The guy from Worcester, I think, is left, but a lot of them get changed out right away.
So. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Bayeux Tapestry. Talking about grandeur of architecture, here we have a grandeur of the textile. I mean, in a sense, it's huge. It's absolutely impressive, and I've seen it displayed, and it just goes meters and meters and meters of this textile. And every time I see such minute work, craftsmanship, I always feel, who were these people that were tasked to do this? How many people would have worked on this, and for how long? Because this is such an impressive textile with so much minute work put into it. What's your take on this textile, also from art historical point of view?
Yeah, I mean, Anglo-Saxons were really famous for their embroidery. So really, there, it's kind of like having people tell the story of their takeover in their best medium, you know, with the embroidery. There's a lot of debate. I mean, most people think it probably comes from the area around Canterbury. There are links with some manuscript tradition there, things about the language that link it with that as well. Then there's a lot of debate about the borders and whether the borders are subverting the major narrative, you know, as if there are these Anglo-Saxons kind of putting code in. But, you know, it's hard to know whether that's the case. And so it is very much in this Anglo-Saxon tradition, but the narrative, the story is definitely pro-Norman. There have been some suggestions that it might have been displayed in England. There are all kinds of views about how it was probably made for William's brother, Bishop Odo, who's his half-brother, who basically kind of serves as regent when William goes back to Normandy, and who has this kind of major kind of judicial judge position. And so one suggestion is that the tapestry actually traveled around with him, or technically it's really an embroidery. There's another person who recently suggested that it was in St. Augustine's Abbey, but probably the most convincing thing is actually Christopher Norton from York pretty recently did a very detailed study with the measurements of this and Bayeux Cathedral, and Odo is Bishop of Bayeux. And although much of Bayeux is rebuilt, the basic footprint with the columns and stuff is the same, and kind of worked out how it would have fit within that cathedral, which is where it's ultimately found, and that it would have been a kind of setting for Odo in his home cathedral, which is certainly possible. But how long it, you know, how many people and how long it took, I'm not sure. I'm sure there's somebody who knows how long it takes to do, you know, this kind of embroidery, but I don't know about that part of it. But the detail is really spectacular. And it's also, I mean, it's interesting because it's, you know, a piece of Norman propaganda produced by the oppressed, basically. But it also has these vignettes of everyday life. You know, you can see armor, you can see people at a feast, you can see what kind of boats. The boats are very much like Viking boats that you see them sailing across on. So it's this real window into what things look like at that time, and you know, kind of what things, and the whole thing with like Halley's Comet, where, I mean, it's obviously not called Halley's Comet in 1066, but, you know, they're pointing at the star, which we know was Halley's Comet that appeared, and the kind of observation of the natural world make it this great window into life at that time, as well as how the Normans want to present themselves as absolutely like, this is what should happen because it's our country. It's legitimately our country. So
yes, fascinating. Definitely an incredible piece of medieval propaganda, as well as medieval craftsmanship or artistry. I also find it fascinating that you say the Anglo-Saxons produced it for the Normans, because this ties really beautifully with the cape, the mantle for the Roger II in Sicily, which was equally produced by Muslim artisans for the new usurpers, if we can call them like that, in Palermo. So it's definitely, I think, something to connect in knowing that Normans were not just shrewd politicians, but they also recognized the value of art and selected the best of the best for their own political agenda.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, when I started doing this project, you know, looking at building, you know, Normandy and England, you can make the connection between sources and things like that. But, you know, with Sicily, and we should say that it's not like William the Conqueror goes down and builds buildings in Sicily. It's basically younger sons and brothers who are not inheriting property within the aristocracy because it's primogeniture, who, you know, go off really as kind of mercenaries and then end up having been hired by these independent Muslim little districts that are fighting against each other at this point. They're hired as kind of mercenaries, but then realize you know, that they can just take over for themselves and conquer southern Italy and Sicily. So it's a different group of, it's different people specifically, although they retain contact with Normandy. We know that Norman monks come down, Norman chants come down. You know, everybody's kind of stopping off in Sicily anyway, because it's like the major point in the middle of the Mediterranean, whether it's for trade or going on to crusade. But, you know, the kind of argument in the book is that even when things don't look the same, the kind of mental process they seem to be going through, their approach to how do I represent myself as a legitimate ruler, when at best for William, it's questioned, and for the other two, you know, it's basically that they just squashed other people and got put into power. You know, is it seems to be the same kind of idea. You need to look like other kings. You need to become approved by the church and show yourself to be a Christian ruler. That seems to be really important. And you want to have this sense of continuity with earlier traditions, whether through sites or visual vocabulary. And you want to use a language that's familiar to other rulers who the Normans considered their peers, although I don't think the other rulers necessarily considered the Normans their peers so much, you know, so that you appear to be a ruler. And this patronage, whether of the cloak or buildings or whatever else, is all part of that, what goes on there. And the cloak is, to me, the cloak is really interesting because it's a type of garment that's not from Sicily. You know, as far as we know, Muslim rulers aren't wearing capes like that. That, you know, I talk in the book about how it's much more the Holy Roman Empire, Northern Europe, where you get these mantles. So that shape of garment doesn't seem to be something that the Muslim craftsmen at this workshop that was still there from the period of Muslim rule would have been familiar with. But then the technique of embroidery is the materials are unbelievably lavish. The pearls they now think came from the Eastern Mediterranean. I don't know how many thousands of those there are, as well as, you know, rubies and sapphires, the gold thread, cloisonné enamel plaques, you know, and then this phenomenal inscription in gold in Kufic script, identifying the date and that it was specifically made for Roger, you know, kind of showing like, I've really conquered you because I've even got your language on my cloak, which is called a coronation robe, but it was actually made after he was crowned. So I think he wore it, just not for other people wore it for their coronations, but not him. So, yeah.
And it's pretty, really large. So when you see it displayed today, we can tell our listeners it is in Vienna in the treasury there. It's huge. It must have been also very heavy, and it would cover the whole body. So it would go all the way down to the floor. So definitely something that would be used along with other royal regalia for, you know, some of those processions or, visits or something like that.
No, I measured, I took the measurements, and if you were 6'2", it would like come down to like the bottom of your ankle. That's how big it is, which is really big, you know, and as you say, it's really heavy. And then you'd have those, if you're wearing it, the lions on it are under your face, basically on either side, which are this royal emblem. And Roger's often described as leonine in appearance, which doesn't mean he actually did look like a lion as much as that's part of the association with a ruler. And then that tree of life, which is associated with paradise, is right down his spine at the back. So, I mean, that's part of what I talk about, is that we always see it flat out, but it would be interesting to kind of make a copy and put it on somebody, you know, to see what it would actually look like on, you know, but it must have weighed a ton.
Yeah, there are depictions how the mantle supposed to look like when worn. We have Dürer's depiction about
exactly,
it.
Exactly. We do. But I think it would be interesting to kind of do a 3D model and show it.
Yeah. You know. Oh, yeah, definitely. We should initiate that so that we can play around with it.
I know.
That would be fantastic. Well, we are nearly at the end of our talk today. And I am Tanya Toller, talking to Lisa Riley about her book, The Invention of Norman Visual Culture, Art art politics and dynastic ambition. So one of the elements at the end when you're discussing Sicily is also the reuse of material culture that precedes Norman rule in Sicily, the use of spolia. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what would Roger, particularly Roger II and William I and William II, what would they gain by using old material for this new kingdom?
Well, I think they gained a lot. The columns, we think, actually came from Rome itself in the Capella Palatina, even though, I mean, there are Roman ruins all over Sicily, so it's not like you had to get exports. But I think it's something that we see others in the Mediterranean doing, first of all, like Hagia Sophia, other Byzantine churches. We see this reuse of Roman materials. The Dome of the Rock, you know, the first major Muslim site, Great Mosque of Damascus earlier than this. So this idea, again, of continuity, of inserting yourself into the narrative. I mean, people do tend to refer back to the Romans as their ancestors quite often, but also as the kind of beginning of rule. You know, the whole Mediterranean has this common foundation of Roman culture. And so we see all of the major players, whether Byzantine, Muslim, or Western Christian, like Roger, using vocabularies from Rome, ancient Rome, as well as these materials. And then the use of porphyry, which is that dark purplish stone, the quarries have been lost that are in Egypt by this point, but we see him bringing porphyry, which is, you know, the Romans were using in an imperial setting, and, you know, it's being broken up sometimes for pavements. It's being recarved in his case for sarcophagi, and he has this enormous porphyry disc put, so it's like basically right behind his head on the throne. And then often you see porphyry columns right up by the altar, giving this kind of special imprimatur with that. So I think it's this idea that there's a familiarity with this language as a language associated with rule and elites that's common to everybody in the Mediterranean. And so they all use it. And he's just following in that kind of tradition in his use of spolia. You know, I talk about how he literally uses it. And then sometimes it's like he's quoting from the past too. I mean, they all do that. They kind of quote from the past in this more virtual way.
Yeah, so I think what you touch upon here is to kind of look at this joined language within the Mediterranean middle-aged cultures rather than a singled out in combat type of thing seen culturally isolated regions. And it's something that's been going on for the past decade or so with among art historians to sort of walk away from distinguishing Byzantine versus Islamic versus Western European Latin cultures and trying to see this sort of joint expression of Mediterraneanism, so to speak. And you speak about this in one of your concluding remarks as well.
Yeah, no, I feel pretty strongly that that kind of compartmentalization was, you know, of an art, which, you know, it partly, you know, relates to colonialism, partly relates to the way art history itself was created and this focus on style. I mean, because basically something like Sicily, no, it didn't fit into any of those categories, which is why it was ignored. So understanding that there wasn't that kind of approach where, you know, only Muslims did X and only Christians did Y. There's no real evidence for this when you look at these buildings.
Yeah. So. Well, people live together even when they're conquered.
Exactly.
They survive and they live together. Well, Lisa, we've taken up a lot of your time and we talked about Normans in France and England and in Sicily. For the final question, if I may, I'd like to ask you what you would suggest to our listeners if they'd like to explore Norman culture firsthand. Which location should they visit and why?
Oh, gosh.
I know. I needed to finish on a tricky question.
It is tricky. I mean, I would probably say two things. I would probably say Durham is really spectacular and kind of seals the deal, where we're building something like no one's seen before, but bringing all these other things in on a tremendous scale and reusing this site. And then also I would say you want to go to, I mean, there's a lot of Norman buildings in Sicily, not just the Cappella Palatina, but the Cappella Palatina is the place that really brings together these Byzantine craftsmen, these fabulous Mukarna ceilings, as well as the spolia. And it's just visually so lavish. I mean, you don't know where to look first because it's so incredible. And so that those would be, I'd have to do two, not one. I feel like, you know, on Desert Island Discs, I'm only supposed to pick one thing. But I'm going to say two.
Brilliant. Well, I can assure you that it's an excellent two suggestions, both very impressive. And I like to say, and we study them as a all-rounded object. So it's not just a architecture and an architectural object, but an all-rounded object with all the additions to it, okay, inside and outside. So Lizzarelli, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book project. Thank you.
Thank you. And to you, our listeners, thank you. And till next time, goodbye.